Good evening. Good evening. My name is Sherry Zhong, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, the departments of Middle East Studies, Political Science, History, Sociology, Religion, and Community Studies Center, I would like to welcome you to this evening's program, Backlash 9/11. On September 11, 2001, a group of 19 Al-Qaeda terrorists attacked in New York and Washington, D.C. Two hijacked jetliners slammed into the World Trade Center, and another one collided into the Pentagon. A fourth airliner crashed in a field in Pennsylvania. 2,973 victims, as well as the 19 hijackers, died as a result of the attacks. For most Americans, this is a day which prompted the war on terror. But for most Middle Eastern and Muslim Americans, it is also a day which unleashed a hatred backlash against them. The backlash takes the form of racial jokes made in the workplace, verbal harassment in the streets, phone threats to individuals in their homes, property damage, and violence at places of worship, and tragically, the shooting deaths of several individuals. In America's war on terror, the government passed the USA Patriot Act and a series of other initiatives that resulted in the detention and deportation of several thousands, mostly Arab and Muslim immigrant men. The post-9/11 climate in the country rattled the Middle Eastern American communities and left many fearful and alienated. We are fortunate to have with us tonight Mehdi Borzorgmehr, the co-author of Backlash 9/11, Middle Eastern and Muslim Americans Respond. Borzorgmehr is the founding co-director of the Middle East and Middle Eastern American Center at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and a professor of sociology. He's also a co-editor of the award-winning Ethnic Los Angeles and has published over 60 articles, book chapters, and encyclopedia entries. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. Also, since this program is being taped and some of our audio members may be hearing impaired, please wait for the microphone to reach you before asking a question during the question and answer session at the end of the program. Thank you, and now please join me in welcoming Mehdi Borzorgmehr.
Thank you very much. Okay, can you hear me all right? Okay, Sherry gave half of the lecture, so that cuts my time by half. That's great. And I wanted to thank first and foremost Eric Love, Professor Love, as you call him, for initiating this process of inviting me here, and of course the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues for hosting this event, Professor Harry Pullman, who has a terrible cold and sitting back away from every one of us so we don't catch his cooties. And also Jolie Rankin for facilitating my trip. And this is, in a sense, sort of a homecoming for me. I have been coming here since long before most of you were born, in the centennial year, 1976, and have an affinity for Carlisle, Pennsylvania, much to your surprise, hailing from Tehran via London, via Los Angeles, and via New York. So the Carlisle is up there, as far as I'm concerned, in the ranking in the world cities. You may not believe that, but for me it is, at least. In my imagination it is. And the last time I was here, in 1998, it was also a Clark Forum event. It was a conference on citizenship and identity, and my book, Ethnic Los Angeles, which Sherry talked about, had just come out, and I came and gave sort of a summary of the book. So the, I guess, moral of the story is that I got to crank out more books more frequently so I can get invited to Clark Forum more regularly, and not so much time will pass in between the two. I'm going to kind of walk you through some slides, and then I'll try to make it, keep it short as much as possible. And I wanted to, then we'll open it to question and answer. I also wanted to acknowledge the help of Professor Helene Kim Lee, who has been a very, very gracious host to me. We are sort of inundated now and pretty much preoccupied with the events that are happening in Arizona, right? I mean, virtually all of you know about this, right? And I don't have to go over it with you. But I wanted to bring to your attention some kind of, it sounds like the voice echoes better from here, but I need to walk around. I wanted to kind of bring to your attention what happened on July 24, 2002, that many of us will not know or remember or have any ideas about. And this is from the chronology of government initiatives that appears in the appendix to our book. The Department of Justice issued a final rule allowing the Attorney General to authorize any state or local law enforcement officer with the consent of the head of the department, whose geographic boundary the officer is serving, to exercise and enforce immigration laws during the period of a declared mass influx of aliens, in quotes. Okay? And this continued to September 2002, where Florida, again, another singular state, signed a memorandum of understanding with the FBI to deputize its state and local police to enforce immigration violations. And of course, they rescinded this law because they found that it was they backed off from it, you know. And this was also happening in Alabama and Virginia. So while we may not remember that, but we have to know that is precursors like that that kind of facilitate and pave the way for events like today that we are facing. Okay. And while it may not affect us then, it may not have affected us then, at least not most of us, it's affecting our communities now. And this is why I think we need to sort of be aware and attentive to some of these government initiatives that sort of poke their ugly heads down the line. And along those lines, we were having an interview just right before here with Sherry, and she was asking all these sort of very insightful and challenging questions, trying to sort of go over the 9/11 and what are the lessons to be learned from it. So I wanted to kind of like walk you through some of this and tell you a little bit about what we did and what did we learn from it and where do we stand now. First of all, how did this book come about? I've learned from a couple of talks that I've given in the last couple of weeks, one in Eric's class a couple of days ago. Was it a couple of days or yesterday? Yesterday. It already feels like a couple of days ago. And one at Fordham University last week. And I'm on sabbatical this year, so I've only taught twice in the entire year. And I sort of believe that if you can only teach twice a year, teaching is a great profession. But if you have to do it more than that, then it's really, especially the grading. The teaching is great. The grading is the part that's a killer. So what we basically did was that we had established our center, which you heard about, Middle East and Middle Eastern American Center. Literally, it was officially approved a week before 9/11. You know, and imagine that if 9/11 had happened, our center would probably have never been approved. In fact, our center was up for voting, you know, by the university sort of board, you know, the higher board, and over the summer. And they delayed it because of the intifada, the uprisings in the West Bank, in Israel. And so Palestine, depending on where you stand. So when our center was had been established, and then 9/11 happened, and I seemed to kind of like follow disasters, as we were talking before. I did the Ethnic Los Angeles book after the LA riots. I did the 9/11 thing after the you know, sort of attacks on World Trade Center. Don't panic. Hopefully nothing will happen while I'm here until Thursday. But basically what we did was that, just like sort of 9/11, as Eric and I were talking about looking at the documentary last night, 9/11 is not the sort of the starting point, you know, for all events. You know, the same thing with our book. You know, the center already had been in implementation for a couple of years. And while we were doing that, you know, I had put together, edited, and contributed some material to a handbook. It was really a sort of like a curriculum guide for on Middle Eastern American philanthropy. And in the course of doing that, we basically had come up with a list of organizations, something that you can easily do off the web, you know, just sort of download all these, you know, organizations. And do you still hear me? Can you hear me all right? Okay, great. And sounds like that commercial. And in the course of doing that, you know, we had compiled this list of organizations. So when 9/11 happened, you know, what we wanted to do was to we heard that the National Science Foundation had a request for proposals, you know, looking at any aspect of 9/11. You know, so we sort of applied, and I'll tell you a little bit about that in a second. But the idea was that, you know, we sort of went over different methods of trying to study this phenomenon, and we thought that it would be most expedient and least costly, they liked that idea, you know, to sort of approach these organizations. Little did we know at that time that these organizations are going to be sort of the major intermediaries between the society, the state, the government, and their constituencies later on. So basically we interviewed 60 organizational leaders. This may not sound like a lot to you, but really at that time there were not that many more organizations virtually around the country. Eric is following up on this in his research, and there were probably still probably less than 100 or so major organizations. So what we did was that we said we already have this list of these organizations, so what we want to do is to sort of interview organizational leaders or people as high up as possible. And then we did this other thing, and that is interviews with civil rights groups and government officials. Why did we do that? Because, first of all, when you talk to advocates, you know, to organizations that are engaged in advocacy, and virtually all these organizations, even if they were grassroots organizations, they became advocates. You know, they engaged in advocacy after 9/11. They had to do that. There was just too much sort of a backlash against the communities. So what we sort of did was that we thought that, okay, organizational advocates are going to be very, very subjective as far as the interest of their organizations are concerned, right? So we wanted to kind of like balance these with some, you know, to get the other side of the story. And the other side of the story would have been people who were with civil rights and government officials. And we did interview some relatively very high-level government officials. Of course, for the sake of anonymity and confidentiality of research, we don't disclose any of these names. And this is why our book is so sterile when you read it, you know. Such and such member of such and such, you know, so we don't even mention the names, you know, of organizations did that or said that. And then we continued sort of what is interesting is that when we did our research, it was from 2001 to 2003 or so, the interviews, and of course, you know, the process of book writing took a lot longer, you know, and hence we stayed with the project by being involved in metropolitan New York communities. We are sitting in the proverbial sort of ivory tower. We are only at CUNY, after all. We are not Columbia or Princeton. So we are out there getting our feet dirty and sort of talk to people in the community. And, of course, this thing, lastly, which is a very, very useful research tool for many of you for your papers. I'm sure, you know, the great thing about Dickinson, from probably your point of view, because you have to write all these papers, but, you know, there is a lot of writing involved. And these web listservs and the press releases of organizations, as well as media, right, the print media, are an incredible resource for sort of keeping up. And, in fact, a lot of our book, the part that deals with the response of these communities, all draws from these, because we already by then had come out of the field, you know. So now I wanted to kind of talk to you about this model quickly. You know, it's kind of interesting because we keep hearing the word backlash, right? I mean, people always, in fact, in this video we watched last night, you know, it was uttered frequently too. But nobody really, it's a folk concept, right? I mean, backlash is really a sort of concept that people use, you know, to sort of talk about experiences that individuals or groups, you know, or societies for that matter, have. But we try to, in trying to kind of approach this somewhat scientifically, you know, we had to really sort of develop it, define it, and talk about its different characteristics. One of the first things that we did, one of the things that we did is that we sort of talked decided to develop a model of backlash and mobilization. You know, this is something that's often the case when you're doing social science research, right? You know, if you study your community, you know, somebody will say, okay, that's great, but why should I be interested in that, right? Why should I be interested in a specific, you know, case study, right? So no matter what you do, you always sort of try to attempt at some broad generalization, something that is applies to that does apply to other cases. And what we thought would be very meaningful is to look at similar situation. You know, so what prompted this backlash? What is the sort of the cause? If you think of this as the effect, this is the cause, right? What's the cause of this? And the cause of this, you know, in the American context, in a sort of historical context, is war or political ideological crisis. Whether this is sort of war, you know, like in the case of the World War, whether it is sort of the threat of communism, whether it's the threat of Al-Qaeda, whatever it is, you know, that's sort of the precursor of it, right? And then it results in backlash, you know, and of course, most of the time you just stop there, you know, right? Because that's what happens. But clearly, some other sort of things were unfolding here, namely what followed the backlash. So in other words, if this is the so-called independent variable, then this is the dependent variable, cause and effect, this becomes really more like the intervening variable, and this becomes the dependent variable, or this, for that matter. These become, you know, intervening variables. Enough methods, okay? So that's, and of course, these lines are sort of, you know, these could very well be broken lines because, you know, these could take a long time. Some of these may not really be actualized or realized, you know, so we sort of like, for the sake of simplicity, you know, we've put it like this. So what's the mobilization for? In other words, when the communities respond, when they collectively organize to challenge the backlash, right, what is the upshot of that? The upshot of that is actually this paradox. You see, this is a very interesting issue. The paradox is that they become more politically integrated and they engage in more political participation. They get more, you know, engage in more civic engagement and so on and so forth, right? And this is quite fascinating because because the idea here is that if you are experiencing backlash, you are going to be marginalized, right? You're going to be more disenfranchised, right? And then you're going to, so one possibility is to lay low, right? To just kind of like, you know, disassociate, for instance, from being, from that part of the world, right? Passing, so-called passing, you know, right? My cousin, who is a very light color, he's sort of blonde hair, well, when he had hair, and blue eyes. And when they would ask him during the Iran hostage crisis, where are you from? He would say, Luxembourg, you know. I mean, he's from Iran, and he would say Luxembourg. And then he would get responses like, oh, amazing, I've never met anybody from Luxembourg. And he would say, great, you know. So this is a sort of the idea of passing was something that's very common. After all, a lot of Middle Easterners pass as whites, you know, and in fact, they're regarded as whites, you know, right? Caucasian, Caucasus, you know, Armenia, Southern Soviet Union. So some of them come from that part of the world. So the idea here was that no longer works for these communities. You know, they really, because you can pass in public encounters, right? If you ask me what am I, right? I could tell you, I could make up something, you know, would be safe here, right? People usually, when I go in rural areas and they ask me this pointed question, where are you from? And I know they're trying to get at this, you know, like underlying ethnicity. And I say, New York. They say, well, where are you really from? I say, well, Los Angeles. They say, no, where are you really from? You know, so then I finally tell them Iran. If they're that curious, they're probably very sympathetic. Although these days, Iranians are not very popular. Has been the case for the last 30 years, by the way. So the idea here, then, is that you can do that in public. You can disassociate, but you can't do it when you're dealing with the government, right? When you're coming through the airport, as I do, and I get these four S's, security check, you know, virtually every time that I come back from Iran, you know that you really cannot pass. You try to tell the immigration officer, sorry, sir, there's a mistake in that passport. I'm really from Costa Rica, but I don't think that's going to go over very well. So then we sort of like thought about Sherry again was asking me, how do you define backlash? But this is really a sort of a way that we conceptualize backlash. Backlash is really, often when we think about it, we sort of think about, you know, these areas, right? Scapegoating, stereotyping, discrimination. In other words, people are sort of become scapegoated for something that is happening elsewhere that they have practically not much to do with, right? And this is very, very often, it happens with ethnic minorities, with immigrants quite often. So the result of it is that is hate crimes, you know, or bias incidents. Hate crime is a more legal sort of codified version of bias incidents, you know, discrimination, prejudice, things like that, that's in this area. And then, of course, you have state government policies, right? And the interesting thing is that this would be the USA Patriot Act that you talked about, all the other initiatives, including the one I just read to you, the one that we are hearing right now in sort of in Arizona, right? And, of course, in this case, in Arizona, is a state, literally. We're talking about the state or government, federal government. And as you see these arrows, they feed into each other, right? In other words, you know, and you really have to have these as a precursor, as a background, in order to engage in these. You cannot just sort of like literally go out and sort of, demonize a group when there is not some kind of historical pretext to it, right? And we argue that these things go a long ways back. Actually, they go back to literally the turn of the previous century, starting with Hollywood, actually. Hollywood has been making movies about the Middle Easterners for the last 100 years or so, something in the range of 900-plus movies, of which there are only 50 of them that are actually neutral, and only a handful that are favorable, right? I mean, imagine that. So there's been this notion of being a terrorist, being a hostage taker, being a womanizer, a savage. All these things are very much in the popular media. And a good friend of mine at UCLA is doing a huge project, which I'll share with you the link. It's called American Orientalism, and sort of tracking all these things. And you see this in other things, other romanticization that we have. Camel cigarettes, this image of we have of the Middle East, right? Even if it has not. Or just think about all the buildings that you have in Vegas, the pyramids, the variety of things that sort of like conjure up this image of Middle East as exotic, right? Things that Edward Said so beautifully laid out in Orientalism, which I strongly recommend you read. When we talk about the mobilization part, I just want to put this up, and I sort of won't bother you with it, but. These are the different components of mobilization. And one of the things that we had to do in our book, don't sort of trouble your eyes with this, bear with me, because this is complicated, I'll get to it in a second. But one of the things that we sort of realized was, that there's a sort of a disconnect, in our sort of age of high specialization in academia between different bodies of work, right? On the one hand, you have people like myself, who are immigration, race, ethnicity, right? Who deal with these groups, but really don't get into the sort of the mobilization part. We talk about the extent to which groups organize to advance their interests, right? On the other hand, who does deal with mobilization? If any of you have taken courses in social movements, right, political movements, you see that's what they all talk about, mobilization. But lo and behold, they don't do anything with ethnicity or religion. So these two disciplines don't really meet, in fact, this was a very challenging part because we had to sort of get a grounding in the social movement, which is a very thriving literature. So we were fortunate enough to have an excellent graduate student who at the time was teaching a course on social movement at one of the CUNY campuses, and we subscribed to her help. And luckily, I had started my career in sociology and social movements because, after all, I was in chemical engineering and organic chemistry undergraduate, and I switched to sociology after something big happened in my homeland, a revolution. And I started with studying revolutions. Why do revolutions happen? How do they come about? And so on and so forth. So I had some background in this. Okay, so I wanted to kind of like bring this thing to your attention very quickly. How am I doing on time? And let me just go back. Okay, so I want to sort of like lay out like three historical precedents. And this is, again, another sort of effort that we made. And that is that, you know, what do we compare this to? Okay, so you have this 9/11, you have this post-9/11 backlash, but what else is out there? I mean, how do you know what is different? What is the same? You know, what do you sort of, looking at these different, as different events, you know, what do you surmise from them? And of course, the closest thing that the book, there's a longer list, but the closest event is what happened to German Americans during the First World War. After all, you know, they're concerned that they might side with the German expansionist, you know, ideas, with the Japanese internment during the World War II, I'll get to in a second, and of course the Iran hostage crisis in 1979-81, something that most people actually leave out, but I personally am very aware of that because I was subject to deportation myself during that time. All you needed to do is to somehow be out of status, right, in this country. And because the students, so-called students, held 53 American hostages in Iran for 444 days, right, what did the U.S. government do? They tried sort of in retribution to examine that all Iranian students in this country, all 57,000 of them, at that time, one out of every six foreign students in the country was from Iran. So Iran was the largest exporter of foreign students in the world. If they were in violation of their visa, they were subject to deportation. And you really, it's so easy to violate your visa, right? All you need to do is not have a full load of classes, right? Or work off campus, you know? So in my own case, I had come to the U.S. From London. And as you know, when you first enter the country, you've got to go through the immigration at the first port of entry, right? And it was Philadelphia. And my first exposure to America, well, practical, physical, you know, and personal exposure, was these two gentlemen walked up to me and pulled out their badge and said, FBI, follow me. You know, don't mess with the FBI. I followed them. So they took me to this room and they virtually searched everything I had. I mean, it was unbelievable, and it was quite interesting. And at that time, you know, I was a teenager. You know, I really didn't know much about this. And you know how you're sort of rebellious and you don't want to deal with authority too much. So I started challenging them. I really should have known better. Now I know I've learned my lesson. So I started sort of like quizzing them. You know, and I remember there's something that actually you might find amusing. I had brought a huge sort of container of conditioner, hair conditioner. I had hair at that time. But I was losing it. And in fact, I had very long hair and I had a very long beard. This is, by the way, you know, 70s, you know, my idol was Cat Stevens, so I wanted to look like Cat Stevens, you know. By the way, Yusuf Islam now, as he's converted. So I'm not sure when he's still my idol, but anyway, then he was. So because my hair was falling out, I had gone to this treatment center, you know, which actually Rolling Stones used to frequent, some of them, and they'd given me this huge jar of conditioner, you know. So, and these guys, you know, they had no idea what conditioner was, you know. So they asked me, "What is this?" I said, "This is a hair conditioner." They said, "What is that?" I said, "It's something that you apply after you put shampoo on." And they really just could not believe, because, you know, it looked opaque, it was big, it was sort of like gooey, you know, it could have been a bomb, right? You know, so, and then I remember distinctly that they asked me about, I was wearing a watch, and they found another watch, you know, in my thing, you know, in my bag. And they said, "What is this?" I said, "Watch." I said, what is that?" I said, "This is a watch." I said, "Why do you have two watches?" I said, "Well, you know, so." Anyway, but, my problem was that I was nervous that I was going to lose my flight, you know, miss my connection, right? And finally, I sort of raised the question. I asked them, "Well, what are you looking for? I mean, who are you looking for?" He said, "Well, we were informed to look for somebody with long hair and beard." At that time, I mean, you know, half of the young people, men, had long beards and hair. But actually, now that I think about it, I thought that that time may have been drug-related, but I really think that it's probably more sort of political-related. You know, I've sort of like thought about, if I keep talking about this, I'll come up with interesting scenarios in my mind. So anyway, so and then what happened, you know, was that they took my I-94 is essentially this sort of that card, the form that's attached to your passport, right? And it allows you to stay, you know, in the country as long as you're a student, right? And I had a DS, which was really a very rare I-94. I see some other people with I-94 here, which meant for duration of status. In other words, as long as I was a student, I could have stayed, you know, in this country. So, you know, things were much more lenient then. So, of course, you know, as you know, with the former INS, now the current Department of Homeland Security has got its act together. There's no comparison, in fact, with what it used to be. But they were notoriously inefficient. You know, in fact, somebody wrote a book called the INS, the story, history of neglect. I mean, so they were inefficient partly because they don't have to account to Americans, right? They're dealing with non-citizens, they're dealing with immigrants. You know, there's no accountability, right? So they were supposed to mail this to me, and I never got it. And you know, you're a student, you're going about your life. And nobody really checked. Initially, there was this sort of, they had a system where you had to, every year, let the INS know where you were. And of course, they abandoned it because they had no way of recording all this information. So I actually was full-time student. I never really worked off campus, you know, and so on and so forth. But lo and behold, a hostage crisis happens, right? And the INS recalls all these students. You had to go in and you had to let them know your status. And I was out of status. I didn't have a visa, right? So you panic, you freak out. You know, you say, well, oh my God, they're going to kick me out of this country. You don't know what lawyers can do. You know, I mean, you get a lawyer, you pay them a little money, they'll do marvels. You know, so basically, I sort of managed to get out of that deportation hearings. But at that time, you know, about 1,000 or so Iranians were actually subject to deportation, and several hundred left. But not as bad as it may have seemed. So anyway, if you look at this thing, which you probably can't see very well from way back when, but I wanted to kind of like bring to you some of the things that are very interesting and important. One is that, you know, what are the different components of the crisis? And then these are the ones that I mentioned to you and the backlash here. And we are looking at a different sort of dimensions of this, right? The causes of crisis, which groups were targeted, what was the legal status of targeted population, government policy, yield from government investigation, and of course, as we went along in this model, we added the response of impacted groups. Now, what you want to do is that you want to look across. You want to look at the rows. You don't want to look at necessarily columns. You want to look at the rows here and see what is different. Okay? So what are some of the big differences? One obviously big difference is the extent or the groups that were affected, right? And you see that in these cases, it's single groups, right? And whereas here, you're talking about a multiple, you know, sort of category. A category that consists of Middle Easterners, you know, Arabs from 22 countries, Iranians, Turks, Israelis, the three non-Arab countries in the Middle East, and South Asians, which essentially you're talking about, you know, Bangladeshis, Pakistanis, Afghans. Poor Afghans always fall out of one category or another, but, you know, we can put them in there. So therefore, it is a huge dragnet. It's not just dealing about one nationality. Although, you know, when you're talking about... Sorry, I have to get the hang of this. I guess by the time I leave, I'll learn this. But here, of course, you're talking about several million. You know, this was a very big population. Japanese Americans, you're talking about 120,000. With Iranians, you're about 57,000. But here, you're talking about, again, several million people, right? So this is very important. This is a really an important distinction. And what you see here is that it sort of affected virtually all members of the group, including natural citizens and immigrants. Again, citizens and naturalized citizens. Foreign nationals, mostly students. And here predominantly non-immigrants and non-citizens and immigrants. Okay, so this was, you know, a case of very close profiling. In other words, if the hijackers were non-citizens, were immigrants, right? And they were men, and they were from the Arab countries, and they were Muslim. So the government went after young Arab Muslim immigrant men, right? Initially, at least. So what about the government policy? You know, here you had, we forget about these things, but at the time, you know, there was Germans, of course, you know, are the sort of considered often as the apex of world civilization. After all, they've given us Nietzsche, they've given us Goethe, they've given us Beethoven, they've given us, you know, splendid sort of poetry and classical music and literature. And of course, all of a sudden, the Germans fell out of favor. You know, Beethoven was banned in Boston. You could not hear Beethoven, right? You know, the sauerkraut became liberty cabbage. Okay, you know, just like French fries became freedom fries, you know, in the post 9/11 era, right? And of course, what happened was that the Germans, you know, sort of experienced a lot of involuntary assimilation. Okay, and you know, with the Japanese, of course, it's a very, very tragic episode in American history, where 120,000 Japanese, including 70,000 native-born, about two-thirds native-born citizens, American-born Japanese, second generation, Sansei, the Issei, the immigrant generation, the Sansei, the second generation, that were actually relocated to what was called, you know, sort of relocation centers. But in essence, they're internments, right? And you still see these things. If you, for instance, take a drive from Los Angeles up to Mammoth Lakes to go skiing, you know, on your way up, on your left, you see the Manzanar Relocation Center, where these Japanese were interned. And this literally means that they were completely liquidated. They had to abandon all property, all belongings, you know. And the ironic thing about it is that Japanese Americans, the Sansei, the native-born, were some of the most decorated officers in the U.S. Army at the time. So this is a really, really sad sort of episode in American history, and what is really, really remarkable is how Japanese have sort of pulled themselves up from this kind of tragic background and have emerged as one of the few highly successful American ethnic groups. So, of course, with the Iranians, there was this sort of deportation, and here you're talking about deportation, detention, you know, and a variety of other things that that the book sort of classifies. But let's look at this. This is very interesting. So what happens from all these government initiatives? What's the yield? What is the upshot? What's the result, right? And if you look at this, I mean, this may be a little bit sort of harsh, but really the yield in terms of identifying terrorists, in terms of disclosing terrorist cells, in terms of, you know, really preventing future terrorism, or sort of sympathizers of war, has been quite minimal. So the question that Sherry asked actually was, why does the government do that? And I'm sorry that this is not a real exchange, because I would have preferred that, but perhaps we can do that afterwards. But think about it, and maybe in the discussion section we can address this issue. Why is the government doing that? Why is Arizona doing this thing right now? You know, right? I mean, ask yourself that question. And then, of course, response of impacted groups, right? Rapid assimilation. Japanese actually went along with the government, you know, with the presidential decree. In fact, Japanese American Citizens League, JACL, you know, wholeheartedly endorsed it, because there was an issue of loyalty. Right? If you don't go along with this, it means you're anti-American, and you are further subject to, you know, sort of discrimination. Right? So they went along with it, and of course they launched what we know of is this redress movement that took about 20 years before it was implemented, where the two presidents acknowledged it, and of course they gave a symbolic $20,000 to each survivor of the Japanese internment, which is really nothing, but it was the apology that really mattered, you know, to them. And of course, with the Iranian case, there was a few lawsuits. You know, there was no public sort of, there was no collective response, because many of them had just come in. This is sort of very ironic, because they, or ironic, I should say, when they had just come from or fled or escaped from a regime that they disapproved of, only to be found sort of guilty of association with the regime that's taking hostages. You just imagine yourself. Most of the, in fact, this is really a case for most Middle Easterners. Middle Easterners are, the Middle Eastern immigrants are heavily, sort of the origins of Middle Eastern immigration is heavily political as opposed to economic, the big difference, for instance, between, say, Asian migration, like Korean migration, and, say, Iranian migration, that Korean migration is very economically motivated, whereas Iranian migration is very politically motivated. That one is refugees, the other ones are economic migrants, right? I mean, if you will, such as... So they basically disapprove of the regime, but then they are held accountable for the actions of that regime that they disapprove of, right? And, of course, this is a very interesting issue, which we can again talk in the discussion, and I want to kind of want you to think about that. Some of you are probably still writing some assignments on this, so I don't want to let the cat out of the bag, and you know, so you can think about that one. How am I doing on time, sir? Okay, I'm going to make it fast here, because you have to be very efficient, because all restaurants in Carlisle close by 9 o'clock. So if you want to eat, you gotta get done with the lecture. Not just me, but you too, right? Okay. Don't eat fast food; it's bad for you. They're open, but go to the good place. Okay. So these are some of the things that I talked about here. Okay. And I don't need to sort of go over this with you. I've talked about some of these things. We don't need this definition. This is just, I think, something that sort of like, as I said, hate crimes is the sort of official data that the FBI collects. And I guess what you want to look at is this anti-Islamic thing here. That's like two, of course, admittedly, is a low base. So when you have a low base, you're going to have a high percentage increase, right, from 1556 to 2004. But this is huge, right? It's about tenfold, right, at least. And then what you notice is that it sort of continues. It decreases, but stays at higher level than pre-9/11, right? Okay? So, this issue is very, very important. Again, we are talking about profiling, which is the sort of really the central concern in Arizona right now. And, of course, this was the situation, you know, flying while Middle Eastern Muslim, you know, and we heard all kinds of really interesting stories. You know, for instance, one community leader, you know, told us that actually what he does before flying, even if it's on the weekend, you know, he shaves, he showers, he wears a suit and a tie because he doesn't want to be profiled at the airport, you know. So God forbid if you go in there looking, you know, I had two shaves today just in case I get profiles. You know, so, and of course, some markers you cannot escape, like the hijab, right? Like that lady over there is wearing. You know, you cannot escape that. And these markers, you know, or sort of Middle Easterners tend to be also highly entrepreneurial. So there are a lot of businesses with Arabic or Persian or other writing on it. And these are, of course, you know, the sitting ducks for the hate mongers to go after. Now, of course, there were some funny things that produced some T-shirts. One that read that my entry triggers security alerts. You know, what does yours do? You know, so it's kind of funny things like that that they were really. And of course, there's a lot of workplace discrimination that has been reported, and this has continued. And Islamophobia, which is the project of Eric Love, and has written a very, very interesting article on this that's already published. And of course, the role of media, you know, the hate mongers in the media, Fox News, you know, sort of evangelical preachers sometimes, and so on and so forth. But of course, you know, it is not so one-sided. We were talking about this again before in an interview. Is that going to be broadcast? Are they ever going to hear it? Do you want to let them know? When will... Okay, she will tell you when it will be broadcast. I guess after I leave town, so I cannot. There's no accountability. So the role of media is very nuanced. You know, media is not this monolithic thing. I mean, there's clearly a difference between, you know, sort of PBS and Fox News, right? The difference between sort of serious journalism and not so serious journalism. And in fact, the media really did an incredible job at trying to disclose a lot of things. So, for instance, one of the Washington Post, you know, just sort of breathed so heavily on the back of the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, that they finally disclosed that over 1,000 people, they never said how many, but they figured out subsequently about 1,200 people were detained, and they gave sort of a nationality breakdown of these. For a long, long time, you wouldn't know. One of the things that distinguishes 9/11 from all these historical precedents that I talked about is secrecy. If there is one word that, you know, when we're talking about Japanese internment, as heinous and horrendous that it was something that was transparent, right? Here were the Japanese who were relocated. In the case of post 9/11, it's secrecy, right? You didn't know. People, men would just disappear from the communities. Wives would be waiting for the husbands and they would not show up. And they had no idea where they would go. And they would end up in some detention places for years without access to counsel, without being able to call family. Okay, this is really, really an incredible, you know, the whole process was shrouded in secrecy. And of course, it was a dragnet, you know, that it sort of like, you know, cast over a very large population. Okay, so now, this is quite interesting. I'll just tell you, this issue of hate crimes, you know, that is very fascinating because you have a very complicated thing going on. On the one hand, you have hate crimes, which are perpetrated by population, right? And ironically, in areas where you have very high concentration, right? You know, sort of intuitively, we think that if there are more people of Middle Eastern descent or origin, in an area, they're going to be subjected to more hate crimes. But actually, that's not the case. And why is that? Another question that we can save for discussion. I'll get back to that later. Okay? Maybe I should give this one out. Okay, so the reason for that is that they're a known entity. You know, where you're talking about areas like Dearborn, right? Or like Bay Ridge in Brooklyn, or Patterson in New Jersey, right? These populations have a long history of settlement and presence there. And I remember distinctly talking to a sheriff who said, I know these guys are not terrorists. I went to school with them. You know, I know these them from childhood, right? How can we go after them? So in situations like that, you know, they were not, they did not experience that much discrimination. On the other hand, you know, these are also places where the FBI particularly and the INS could move in and pluck people out because there were a lot of, you know, individuals in those communities. Okay, so, you know, and the police, of course, had a much better relations with these community because they do have a very strong kind of neighborhood connection. In fact, they even have public relations people. And one of the things that happened with all sort of due credit, where one should give credit to the police, is that as soon as 9/11 happened, you know, police got out in places like New York, in Washington, in sort of large numbers and went to the mosques, to the schools, to other places to make sure that, you know, there would not be that much hate crime against these populations, right? But of course, it's very different when you're talking about an organic local police than FBI, which, you know, often come from some other place and have no connection to the community. Okay, so the I think I'm going to have to go through these very quickly, and this is a series of government initiatives that the USA Patriot Act is probably the, you know, I'll just sort of say a couple of things about them. But the USA Patriot Act was a document that was 312 pages, like as thick as a phone book, probably thicker than Carlisle, you know, phone book, right? And this was passed overnight with many congressmen not really reading it. I mean, it's impossible to have read that. And there was no objection to it at all. You know, then, of course, there are some very interesting other things like the Absconder Initiative, where, you know, about 300,000 people are awaiting their deportation. These are all people who are supposed to leave the country, who are supposed to be deported, but they're in various stages of sort of challenging the deportation. And what did they do? They went after the 2% of these populations that were Middle Eastern. So the Absconder Initiatives affected those. This NSEERS was something that people coming from about 25 countries in the Middle East and, you know, the Muslim world, you know, would be subject to sort of screening, fingerprinting, and so on and so forth. Anyway, I mean, all of that stuff is there. So the and of course, these are some of the repercussions of government initiatives. You know, clearly, as bad as these communities fared in the sort of event of the hate crimes and bias incidents, they felt that government initiatives were much more damaging. You know, they really, this was a sentiment from all of them. And of course, you know, the erosion of civil rights, something that a lot of people sort of are very concerned with, including now. So I don't want to get into these things, but briefly, you know, the because I think that I'm running out of time. And I just wanted to say that what facilitated this, you know, in other words, we talk about political, this is, remember that sort of model that I put up earlier on, and I said, don't trouble yourself with it. But this is really what facilitated the mobilization of these groups. In other words, the civil rights laws of the mid-60s, the oversight organizations such as ACLU that don't let government get away with abusing civil rights and civil liberties, and of course the Japanese redress movement, you know, which was something that of course the government would learn from that mistake, and it cost the government over $1 billion, you know, not that it sort of mattered as much given how much debt the Bush administration got us in, and of course multiculturalism, you know, which meant that, you know, you cannot, you know, the idea that we are not in a sort of, the dominant ideology is not assimilation, you know, not like what was happening with Germans during the First World War, and hence sort of allowing these. Okay, that I just sort of, I wanted to sort of talk about the way that these communities dealt with this. And of course, one of the things that they had to do is, not to press this, is the condemning terrorism. They all came out and said that they wholeheartedly condemn this terrorist act. And something as simple as that, you will be surprised how many times leaders of these communities were quizzed on that and were probed that how come you don't condemn this? You know, we heard this over and over in our interviews, that how many times should we condemn it before you sort of believe that we mean it? You know, so, and of course, displaying the American flag. This is very important, teaching about Middle East and Islam. And in fact, this is one of the silver lining, few silver linings that came out of 9/11, and that is that to sort of inform Americans more about Middle East and Islam, and as we see, even by huge turnout in this room, and this is part of that whole process. So, of course, they served as consultant to governments. And, of course, you know, they engaged in a series of collective action. They held vigils. They engaged in demonstrations, of course, peaceful demonstration. They had press conferences, releases, and they petitioned elected officials. And, of course, this is very interesting. I think you would get a kick out of this. And this is people like yourself, young people who actually engaged in a variety of artistic efforts, you know, to try to address this. I don't know how many of you have heard of this, but there is a group called the Axis of Evil Comedy Tour, okay? I mean, this, and you can check this on YouTube, I'm sure some of you have looked at it. And these are, you know, sort of often, it's a sort of multitude of countries, the Palestinians, they're Iranians, they're other Arabs, you know, that are other than Palestinians that are involved in this, and they essentially, it's sort of like one person comedy shows, right? And they sort of, and a theme that runs very, very deep is this issue of profiling and 9/11 and so on and so forth. They of course had a lot of other activities, you know, a lot of theatrical expressions, a lot of one-woman shows. Women particularly came through in a very big way, because women, particularly native-born women, second generation, are not threatening, right? They don't have these beards. They don't have, you know, possibility of blowing something up. Unless for Chechnya, of course, you know, sort of suggests otherwise. But you also, they don't have an accent, right? And they engaged in, you know, including a Broadway show. You know, Heather Raffo's Nine Parts of Desire on Broadway, and that was quite interesting. And this continues actually. A lot of this is still going on. Okay, then, of course, you know, as one of the most famous sociologists who just passed away a couple of years ago, Chuck Tilley, would argue that you need resources in order to mobilize. There could be a lot of discontent, there could be a lot of dissatisfaction in many places, but unless you have resources, you cannot engage in any kind of a social movement. And, of course, this last one is quite interesting, which sort of is the way that they went about the political socialization, you know, and they had all these code words, you know, the Yallah vote, for instance. The Yallah means like, come on, get going, right? The Yallah in Arabic. It's a very, very nice expression. If you want to impress an Arab friend, say Yallah, you know, so he's hurry. And in fact, I should Yallah so I can get this lecture done. And of course, there was another one called Rock the Muslim Vote. You know, this is by Muslims, you know, that initiated these things. And of course, it's quite fascinating how the Muslims sort of made a huge U-turn from being pro Republican, you know, sort of candidate to siding with Democrats after 9/11. And of course, this is sort of shamelessly, I'm putting the contributions of our book up there, and I just wanted to kind of like highlight these. Well, first of all, we conceptualize the backlash, something that's not been done before, even if backlash appears as titles of books. The book is nationwide and covers a variety of ethnic groups. It's not just narrowly focused on Arab or Muslim, you know, but includes all groups and, in fact, goes beyond those groups. It's empirical. It's a lot of hard work. You know, this book was just to give you an idea. Students at Fordham told me that it reads. In fact, here too, they said it reads. Doesn't have jargon. It reads well. And the reason for that is that it went through 5 major revisions over 3 years. So it was a killer. You know, I aged in the process. I want to go back there too. Well, I guess it doesn't let me go back, does it? Okay, that's enough contributions. Thank you. All right. But I don't want you all to leave yet, so because we have a little time before the restaurants close, so maybe we can entertain some questions.
At this time, we'll have a short question and answer session. If you have a question, if you could please raise your hand and wait for one of the mic runners to reach you, and please wait until the microphone has reached you before beginning to speak. Are there any questions at this time?
Comments, questions, criticisms, whatever.
I was just wondering if you could expand a little bit on the voting patterns of Muslims.
And the what? Voting patterns?
Yeah. And yeah. If there was like an increase in participation.
Yeah. This is a very interesting issue because virtually any group, right, could claim that they delivered the vote and made the presidency happen if they voted in favor of the Bush. If ever Bush in Florida, right? The margin was so close, right? and this is quite interesting because what the Muslims did is that they struck a deal. They struck a deal with President Bush before 9/11. And the deal was that we will vote in your favor. We will deliver the Muslim vote, okay, to you and to your candidacy if you do something for our community, okay? And what was that they wanted? All they wanted from Bush was to do away with the secret evidence bill that was implemented after the Oklahoma City bombing. After Oklahoma City bombing, which, of course, many of you have heard of and know about, the clear suspects that emerged right away were Middle Easterners, right? Okay? And, in fact, a title of an article in Newsweek, you know, said that we all along thought that it was the Middle Easterners, but the terrorists are homegrown, right? So that, and what happened as the upshot of that secret evidence, which is a very peculiar bill, right? Because what it does is that you can be prosecuted, right? And if your attorney tries to challenge that, the government says they cannot disclose their evidence because it's secret. Imagine trying to defend somebody when you don't know what the evidence is, right? And on that account, many Middle Easterners, some Middle Easterners, including a doctor, had been jailed for 4 years. Completely innocent person, right, had been jailed. So the Muslims, what the Muslims did was that they struck this deal with the Bush, you know, sort of campaign, that we will vote for you if you repeal the secret evidence bill. And you know something that's really incredible, which sort of like baffled me, because on the day of September, the day after September 11, September 12th, right, there was a big sort of denunciation of 9/11 by an umbrella Muslim group, you know, in the country. And I said, my God, these Muslims, how did they get their act together so quickly? And you know what? Why it was the case? Was because the day of September 11, on that Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, they were supposed to meet President Bush in the Rose Garden and where he would sort of start this process of repealing the secret evidence. Of course, 9/11 happened and all bets were off, right? So having this happen, this, when the government did this sort of U-turn and started, you know, targeting these populations, they also, the communities did a turnaround, you know. And also, don't forget, again, something that came up in the interview, that we're not, when you're talking about these communities, you're not just talking about domestic policy, you're also talking about foreign policy, okay? And they hold, and still many hold the government accountable you know, the previous administration accountable for attacking, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, right? And so, you know, because of both foreign policy and because of domestic policies, you know, they there was this huge drive to vote against Republicans.
Has there been an increase?
Yeah, this is another interesting thing. And in fact, this is what you're going to see will happen. This is what you're going to see will happen. It's okay. You know, that's not standard. It's very organized. I really appreciate that, but it only slows us down. So this is what's going to happen with Arizona, too. There's going to be a huge drive. And in fact, there was a drive, you know, when the Welfare Act went into effect. There was a big drive after IRCA, Immigration Reform and Control Act, 1986, where these populations were encouraged to naturalize. And in fact, Republicans have paid a huge price. Because by alienating immigrants, not just Muslims and Middle Easterners, but also Latinos, right, they have pushed these, you know, populations into two things. One is to sort of become naturalized, right, and secondly, to vote against them, right? So this is going to be very interesting because, McCain is up now, you know, his seat is up, and he's getting a lot of heat from this real anti-immigrant candidate. I mean, a serious anti-immigrant candidate, you know. So this is really very interesting to watch. And I hope that you kind of like make the connections between what I've talked about and broader sort of immigration issues and anti-immigrant policies. Let's start with you or her. Sure. Let's start with her. Students have the priority.
I'm wondering to what extent, if any, a surge in patriotism post 9/11 affected hate crimes, specifically citizen ones. Thinking, for instance, the Sikh man killed at the gas station and the murderer claiming, oh, I'm a patriot, I'm an American.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what effect that had.
No, that's a very interesting issue. And, you know, by the way, all of these questions lend themselves to great research papers, you know. So, you know, I hope you think about it along those lines and not just... Because really, there's so little work has been done on these issues that you're asking very, very pertinent, you know, and important questions, and we need to do research on them. You know, this is one area that we really don't know much about. Let's sort of, initially, you see, again, the issue here is that you really have to take a sort of long overview, you know, long-term perspective on this. You know, this is really something that's changing constantly, right? It's a very dynamic, fluid process. Initially, there was obviously that issue. I mean, there are studies that show that flag waving increased, you know, by leaps and bounds, right? You know, but don't forget that Middle Easterners and Muslims partook in that. They were just as much engaged in that, you know. So the and initially, of course, you know, that may have been the case, but over time, it sort of reduced. But let me also, in all fairness, and again, this was something that we talked about to Americans, is that there are far more, in fact, people who are sympathetic to these communities than there are hate mongers here. You know, so and different sort of methods that we can document that. One was, how many people volunteer to help with these causes and these organizations? How many interfaith sort of coalitions were forged? You know, ironically, you know, the sort of one of the groups that came to rescue in a very big way were American Jews, you know, who were particularly the people in the legal profession who were very much, you know, sort of liberal and on the side of these, of course. There was a huge fallout when it comes to Arab-Israeli issue, and that's where on the domestic ground there was a lot of sympathy, but not on the foreign policy ground. And this is what becomes very, very challenging and complicated. But clearly a subject for a paper. You had the question.
Yeah, I was distracted between the agents or participants in the backlash and the fact that there was a did your interviews
seek out people in the government who were drafting legislation or in agencies that were implementing this or amateur professional xenophobes and talk radio and TV, and because the backlash element itself
consists of different segments, or is this sort of a given in the study?
No. That's actually quite an important issue, you know, to attend to. And in fact, to us, you know, the most interesting thing is the legal, you know, component, which is also the toughest, you know, sort of not to crack. You know, in fact, I was just at a conference at Princeton on this topic, and there's a very prominent young, you know, sort of this is a case in point. Yale-educated lawyer who was doing corporate law, who completely shifted and is doing public interest law, and now has become a professor of law. And the question was that, you know, can we explore and see what the mechanism is, you know, in terms of, you know, where did these directives come from? Who initiated that, you know? And she said, no, I mean, this, imagine the sort of secrecy that we have, that how much of that would entail that. But that is, I mean, because the idea, because part of the thing is that why is it that they responded in the way they did, right? Why not, for instance, go whole, you know, full scale after citizens? You know, of course, you know, there were a lot of constitutional legal scholars like David Cole who sort of said that if they go after, in fact, you may be targeted tomorrow. I mean, what's to prevent them from going after Americans, you know, native born, right? Of all, you know, so all kinds of backgrounds. So the issue is that, you know, what prevented them from doing that kind of, you know, we can speculate and say, well, civil rights or this, that, but it's conjectural, you know. What exactly was happening? I mean, that would be, and I think it really requires some kind of a sort of journalist, like a Woodward or somebody, to kind of do something like this, don't you think? I mean, but that's a fabulous question, you know. What is, you know, how did this sort of develop, you know, who brought what up, you know, and particularly in the government initiatives part. You know. Yes.
Hello.
I love Carlisle. I want a t-shirt like that.
She's selling them.
She's selling them. Okay, great. Fantastic.
Okay.
I thought the speakers will get a free one, no?
Well, it goes to a good cause.
Okay.
Okay.
We can bargain Middle Eastern style afterwards and see, and see who's going to win. All right. Okay.
Wholesale.
Sorry, I interrupted your turn.
It's okay. My question has to do with the state. You mentioned that this attack on and the activities following were distinct from anything from the past concerning the Germans and the Japanese,
in
Americans,
some ways, yes.
Because and what it had to do with was a policy of secrecy. So I want to know, besides like the secret evidence law, like how else was that carried out? Because even I'm from New York, and even weeks after September 11th, it was just obviously no one really knew who the terrorists were. But there were all these conspiracies and all these, you know, websites dedicated to September 11th that claimed that the government had something to do with it.
Yeah.
So what is it exactly? Why, I guess, was this mobilization, I guess, against the Middle Eastern community in the United States so secret, as opposed to initiatives in the past?
Okay, that's a very good question. I'm not a sociologist of rumors, but in the absence of information, rumors, you know, sort of sprout up. But your point is well taken, and part of the reason that I think that this was sort of pushed to that degree, and it's kind of a valid one, is that the fear of recurrent attack. I mean, something that actually, to this day, concerns virtually every member of this community's particular organizational leaders, right? So that is something very, very serious. And you can see that even an administration as open-minded and far-sighted and liberal as Obama administration, right, is often pressed against the wall by people like former Vice President Dick Cheney, that is not doing enough to prevent, you know, future attacks, right? So in a one serious case, because remember that this act, I mean, the attack and the almost 3,000 people who perished is far more heinous than anything that happened in U.S. history before, right? The attack on Pearl Harbor, after all, was, you know, on an island, not as many, you know, people directly sort of perished in one instance, nor was it sort of publicized and broadcast, so, you know, sort of readily all over the place and shown over and over and over, you know. So this was a very big deal, you know, and a very big deal in a way for an administration that actually was looking for a very big deal. You know, and this administration, you know, had designs on Iraq, you know, from the get-go. You know, they really wanted Saddam Hussein out, right? And this was the perfect excuse to do that. You know, so it's sort of like, in fact, the administration pretty much was sort of a lawless, you know, if you will, right? And, you know, maybe it's the Texan origin. I know, but I don't know what it is. But it was a, but there is a sort of a, you know, and that, it sort of gave the government, gave that, the Bush administration, a carte blanche to sort of, you know, abuse and override a lot of rights. And, of course, the problem is, I mean, this is, again, a subject of a great paper. I mean, you know, the... This problem is that how do you go about it in an age of the telecommunication, in an age of mass media, where everything is known, right? Perhaps, you know, the best way to do it is secrecy, you know, to be as secretive as possible. And again, on the grounds of security threat, you see, they could advance that kind of secrecy. In other words, we cannot tell you about, and this is, in fact, what is happening even now. Why are we getting so few refugees from Iraq when we are, in principle, responsible for dislocating 2 million people? 2 million Iraqis have left. Where are they? They are in Lebanon and they're in Jordan. How many have come to the U.S.? Less than 10,000. Why is that? It's not actually that the U.S., of course, U.S. has a terrible track record in admitting refugees compared to the Western European countries, you know. But the issue is... security check. Every single one has to go through a tremendous, extensive security check because everyone potentially is a security threat, right? And of course, who are they're not going to share that information with you, right? So I don't know. I'm speculating, but I have a hunch that it is. And also the fact that these watchdogs, you know, and the civil rights community, you know, sort of is constantly breathing down the government's back, you know, including these organizations that we talk about, the newspapers, right? So the more secretive they can be, right? I mean, in other words, you don't let how many people are detained, it doesn't look so bad. People have been detained, right? It could be 5 or it could be 50 or it could be 5,000, right? But once it becomes known that you're dealing with, you know, with how many people, then it becomes much more challenging to defend it. I don't know, just some sort of off-the-cuff thoughts. I don't know, Eric, you have some other thoughts on this? I'm sure you probably do.
Well, I don't want to
ask. No, it's fine, please. You know.
Thanks. I would just say, I mean, about the secrecy specifically, right, it's a great question. And I think there's, if we take a couple specific examples, right, so in 2004, the... FBI undertook, actually was the Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, the FBI, undertook a policy that they called Operation Frontline. And this was a policy, what the idea was to find by analyzing the backgrounds of people in the U.S., particularly immigrants. The idea was they would find terrorist plots that were going to try to disrupt the 2004 elections in the United States, the presidential elections. So, right, we've talked about this in our class, but the entire program was kept entirely secret. It was instituted and it was done. It lasted for over several months. It started in 04 and it continued until the presidential inauguration in 05, completely without any public knowledge. It was done entirely secretly. It was only discovered by a student at Yale Law School and the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in a joint project using the Freedom of Information Act. They managed finally to pull some documents out of the Department of Homeland Security about this program. Why was it kept secret? I mean, you'd have to ask the Department of Homeland Security, I suppose, but I think the reason is because they realize, first of all, I'm sure the reason that DHS would give you is if they exposed the existence of this program, its effectiveness would be nullified. If people were aware that they're being background searched and checked, then they, you know, people would somehow be able then to hide their terrorism, right? And it should be noted this program found no examples of terrorism, and it was proved by Yale Law School to be purposefully discriminatory, despite DHS claiming that it wouldn't discriminate, that they'd check anyone who potentially could possibly be a terrorist. Somewhere around 70% of the people that they checked were Middle Easterners and Muslims. Okay, so the reason they give you a secret is because if people know, then they're going to run away and we won't catch them. But I think the real reason that it's kept secret is because they know it would be so inflammatory if something like this were to come out, that there was this kind of fear about a terrorist attack, right? That the Bush administration would then be trying to amp up the fear and so on. So I think it was politically sensitive, and I think that's the reason why. This is just one example. You can pick many different, any of the other government initiatives that that Professor Bozomer talks about in the book and see a similar sort of rationale that goes on. It doesn't make it good, and I think you're absolutely right that this is a unique aspect of the backlash against Middle Easterners that wasn't true in previous historical cases. Yeah,
this is so secretive that even I didn't know about it. Imagine I wrote a book allegedly on the subject. And the name is ICE, by the way, the acronym, is enough to send chill down your spine. I suggest you think twice about pursuing that research project, especially if it requires asking DHS questions. Okay, well, we have about 8 more minutes before they close the kitchen. So,
is there one more question in the audience?
There it is, right there. I detected the question. Great. You lose 2 minutes in the process right there and then.
You mentioned really briefly a connection about the Hollywood films, and this was actually a question I had been like thinking about even before we started reading this, and like the negative, the negative stereotypes and Orientalism. Yes. So you were beginning to kind of connect them to what you were talking about earlier. I was wondering if you could just like briefly elaborate on that, because you, I guess, stopped for time reasons, but...
Sure. No, there are a lot of things that I mentioned that I didn't connect to what I was talking about, so you're absolutely right. But hopefully... No, that's a perfectly good question. But I kind of wanted to tell you, of course, you can... And again, this is a very interesting project to kind of see how things may have changed, since 9/11, right? But one of the things that I wanted to kind of like shed light on what you're talking about is that we interviewed an organization, that's very active, one of the most active organizations in these communities, right, in Los Angeles. The headquarters are based in Los Angeles, and now they have an office in Washington. And you know what was really incredibly interesting? They said that even if they're sitting right next to Hollywood, they have much less impact or influence, I should say, influence on Hollywood than they have on Washington. In other words, Hollywood, it's sort of its own, master, right? And they have very little input, in that. So that gives you an idea about, but on the other hand, also don't forget that Hollywood produces what the population wants to see, right? if they sort of did not get away with it, they would not produce it. And as there have been some changes recently, there's this book by Jack Shaheen, Real Bad Arab, R-E-E-L. It's a terrible book, but I really strongly recommend it. Because it's just full of description, but it has no analysis. So I think what would be really great is if you take a book like that. Sorry, they take a book. Yeah, and I think what is really, really interesting is to see, there's a woman who is doing who did a phenomenal dissertation, Evelyn Al-Sultani. She's at Michigan. And she is working on a book on this. And if you'd like, I'll share some of the stuff that she's published from it. It's about the images, of Arab in the popular media, particularly in TVs, TV shows, And I think this is beautiful. You could do sort of like an analysis of, some movies. In fact, I strongly urge you to go and see A Prophet, the movie that's showing. If you have not seen that, the movie is showing tomorrow night at 7:30 and Thursday night at 7:30. This is about criminalization of North Africans in France. But, it's a very poignant, very powerful, and sympathetic movie. And Hollywood is showing some stuff that's along those lines. And one of the things that's really changing, and this is what we saw last night, is that people from these communities are making movies. In fact, there's a very rich tradition. For instance, Iranian cinema is one of the best in the world, And people of these communities are getting more and more involved, and they are changing the discourse, right? Because after all, they have the interest of the communities in mind. If any of you wants to talk to me, please feel free to do so. I'm available for a few minutes if you want now. If not, at the quarry in the morning. You know, I get coffee. In fact, one of your students came to quarry this morning, and I tried to flag her down, but she went upstairs quickly, you know, to work and things. But I'm here for a couple more days, and I'll be very happy to stay in touch with you. And one other thing I wanted to say, we have a website that we're launching. It's called Middle Eastern American Resources Online, www.mero.org. And this is going to have a lot of really interesting stuff, including video clips, including, you know, sort of historical material, including, you know, the stuff on literature. And I think it would be very interesting to keep this in mind. And Eric will share with you my email if you're interested to stay in touch with me. New York is only 3.5 hours on a train that's heavily subsidized by beautiful state of Pennsylvania. It costs you less money to go from Carlisle to New York than it cost me to go from my home to the airport in New York City. So feel free to come over. We have a lot of events at our center. In fact, we have an incredible event on May 15th on Future of Democracy in Egypt, where we're bringing in a lot of really, really prominent people from Egypt to talk about this. And we also have concerts and music, and we have great food. So if you come to things. And you don't have to worry about it closing at 9 o'clock, so you can just stay. Okay. Thank you so much.